This episode of Awards Chatter is brought to you by Universal Television, presenting Girls 5 Eva. Girls 5 Eva follows a one-hit wonder 90s girl group who attempts a comeback while hilariously navigating family and relationships, plus the joys and pains of middle age. The show stars Sarah Bareilles, Renee Elise Goldsberry, Paul Appel, and Busy Phillips. Don't miss the series critics call the funniest show on television. Girls 5 Eva is now streaming on Netflix and is for your Emmy consideration for Outstanding Comedy Series and all other eligible categories. Hi, everyone, and thank you for joining us for the 535th episode of the Hollywood Reporter's Awards Chatter podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and for those of you tuning in, this episode is coming to you from Chapman University in Orange County, California, where I'm a trustee professor at the Dodge College of Film and Media Arts, and where an audience of students are with me to welcome our special guest. At just 28, they are already a Critics' Choice and Golden Globe Award-winning and SAG and Emmy Award-nominated actress. Best known for playing Princess Diana from a 16-year-old schoolgirl to a 28-year-old princess on the fourth season of the Netflix drama series The Crown, they have also starred in films such as 2022's My Policeman and Lady Chatterley's Lover, with Deadpool and Wolverine and Nosferatu soon to come. Most recently, though, in 2023, they won raves for their performance on the FX limited series A Murder at the End of the World, created by Britt Marling and Zal Butmanglij, as a young woman named Darby Hart in two different periods of her life that the show cuts back and forth between. As a Gen Z amateur detective investigating unidentified murdered women in the Midwest with her then-boyfriend Bill, and 6 years later as an author acclaimed for her book about those experiences, who is invited to a billionaire's retreat at which Bill, who she hasn't seen since he walked out on her 6 years ago and who is now a famous artist going by Fangs, turns up dead, providing her with one more very personal mystery to solve. Would you please join me in welcoming to the Hollywood Reporter's Awards Chatter Podcast and to Chapman University, Emma Corrin.
Emma, we're so appreciative that you came up. Thank you very much. And first of all, I wonder, have you yourself had the opportunity to, or do you choose to watch your own work? Like, have you gone and watched the entire series back?
I have watched it. When did I watch it? I watched it with my flatmates. I live with four friends and three friends. There are four of us. And yeah, we watched it together, which is always sort of nerve-wracking.
Well, we'll come full circle back around to A Murder at the End of the World in a minute, but But to begin with, can we just establish where were you born and raised and what did your folks do for a living?
I was born and raised in a tiny, really boring town called Sevenoaks outside of London. There were like 15 opticians and not much else in the town. And my parents had a pretty ordinary job. My dad was a businessman. My mom is a speech therapist.
Mm-hmm. Now, you started out at a girls' boarding school, right? And is that right? And my understanding is that it was there that you got the bug of not just acting, right? But it sounds like it was multiple forms of performing. Is this right? Like, how did this get started for you?
It was actually, I think, primary school.
Primary school.
Yeah, I started doing plays there because everyone's sort of forced to do a lot of plays at primary school. You know, like the nativity where you're a spider or something. I was a spider in the nativity. Thank you. Yeah. It's terrifying. The costume was terrifying. And I was also Toad of Toad Hall in, thank you, huge achievement, in Wind of the Willows, and just loved it. I remember it being something I loved. And then when I was choosing a secondary school or high school, I guess, there was one, it was like a Catholic girls' boarding school, help me, where there was an amazing auditorium, but it was an incredible auditorium. They had an orchestra pit that went up and down. I remember that was like a big selling point for them when they were doing the like tour day. Yeah, so I went there and did a lot of plays there. And found a real family in the drama department there, which I was really the key for me to have that support. Yeah, from that.
So the idea, it seems like you had the idea cemented. I'm off to drama school, but there were other plans in the, of the universe for a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. It was that weird thing where I was so protected, I think, at school, but in a good way. I was really supported. I had, yeah, as I said, I had, like, made amazing friends with the staff who ran the drama department, and I sort of would just hang out in their office and when they were like making costumes and stuff and talk to them, and they were so encouraging, and they were like, yeah, you should apply to drama school, and like, no problem. And I think because it's, you know, you're a big fish in a little pond. And then I sort of did all my drama school applications, and my first audition was RADA. And I also had very unorthodox ideas of what I should apply with in terms of auditioning. And I was obsessed with Ben Whishaw, still am. And I'd been to see a play called Peter and Alice. Don't know if you guys have read it or heard of it. It was a Michael Grandage play. I was also obsessed with Michael Grandage's work, which is mad because now I've worked with him, which mm-hmm. is crazy. But he did a play called Peter and Alice with Ben Whishaw and Judi Dench. And it's Ben Whishaw playing young Peter Pan and Judi Dench playing older Alice in Wonderland. And they meet and have this conversation. It's really beautiful. And I really wanted to audition with Ben Whishaw's role, but obviously gender. And so I couldn't do that. And so I was like, well, great. I'll just audition as the, you know, 60-year-old woman. And and no one thought to tell me that was a terrible idea. So I did that in my audition. I just remember looking up after I gave this performance at some very confused faces. And I remember one of them looking down and going, so, Emma, do you have like alternative plans if this doesn't work? Genuinely, do you have other plans if this doesn't work out? And I remember quite optimistically answering that, being like, yeah, I don't know. And then I remember receiving the letter and through the post and going to sit on my bed and opening it, and it saying, you know, it's a no. And I've been crushed. You just feel absolutely crushed. There's no other, like, it was terrible. But obviously in the rosy hues of retrospect, it's, you know, it got me here, I guess, in some way.
Did you ever, were you deterred at any point enough to think about dropping it altogether, acting? Or was there, like, how do you rebound from that?
I didn't ever consider giving up, honestly. I really didn't. And I don't really remember that being, I just don't ever think I wanted to do anything else. I don't think that I ever thought that there could be another option for me, really. At least not until I'd given it everything. And I remember talking to a friend of my mum's who I think had tried a similar path, and but in a different industry, and said, you've got to get beyond the fear of rejection. Mm-hmm. And that really stuck with me. When I was like 17, 18, that really stuck with me. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to embrace the no's. There's going to be a lot of them. I'm just going to like bat them away and keep going. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I didn't get into any drama school, and had some bizarre experiences. Like, the audition process is weird. It's weird what they make you do. Like, I was in one and they were like, 15 of us in a room and everyone giving it like 205%. And I remember they were like, okay, just walk around the space. And they were like, okay, now you're cotton wool. And I'm like looking around and everyone's like taking it really seriously, doing some like crazy shit. And they were like, okay, now you're barbed wire disguised as cotton wool. And I was like, the fuck is this? What? I just want to be Ben Whishaw. What? And it was so strange. Yeah, but you know, it's a learning curve. And
I don't know if I have the chronology correct here, but did you take, after that, you know, kind of period now of uncertainty, rather than go right into school somewhere, was there a bit of a gap year?
Yeah, so while I was applying for drama school, a sensible member of staff at my school was like, why don't you also just apply to a university and see, you know, you have something to do. And so I decided to apply to a drama course at Bristol University, but it wasn't practical drama. It was kind of like the theory, I suppose, generally drama in a general sense. You can tell I paid attention. And I started there and hated it. And I know a lot of people who've loved that course, and it's an incredible course, but it's just not what I wanted to do. I'm interested in the history of drama and the theory behind it. But at that point, I just wanted to learn. I wanted to be performing. I wanted to be learning that skill and using it. And I think it was also before we had a dialogue about mental health. And I think I was very like unhappy there in that city. So I went back to this member of staff who was sort of a guru type person in my life. And I said, I don't know what to do. I'm really unhappy. I want to act. And she said, well, have you considered going to Cambridge? And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, I can't even be cotton wool disguised as barbed wire. I'm never going to get into Cambridge. And she said, well, look, your grades aren't terrible. And there's this course called Education, English and Drama, which is kind of niche. So you don't need to have insanely great grades to get in to that course. And also a lot of people who want to do a lot of drama at Cambridge because it's an incredible theatre scene. It's just student run. And she said a lot of people do that course because it's you can easily work it around the shows you do in your spare time. And I was intrigued enough to go and meet with a tutor there who was this lovely Irish woman called Morag. And she was like, yeah, I would love to have you. Oh my God, apply. And I was like, okay. So yeah, I applied and I got in, which was, I couldn't believe it because I'd never seen that like Cambridge in the cards for me. That was never like, I like a book, but I'm not, I never thought I was like academically smart in that way, which was also really affirming to know that like there are different routes.
Yeah. And you said it was the best 3 years of your life.
Best 3 years of my life. Yeah.
And so you were, I know, doing some theatrical stuff there, but also I believe it was while you were there that at least the first steps into screen acting happened. So how does that, I mean, I think it's a pretty different, you know, art form. I'm not an actor, but then theater work. Were you ready for it? How did the screen acting stuff enter the picture?
I was not ready for it. I did a lot of, well, my course was education. So I was kind of like learning about children's schools and teaching. I did my dissertation on the architecture of children's primary schools. I was like, such a bizarre time. I was like, and then you do a lot of plays. So Cambridge has these two public theatres and you would like constantly, there would be about 7 plays on a week at these theatres at different times during the evening and always like fully attended. We had great audiences from the public and it would all be run by students down from like from the board who selected what plays there'd be to the director, to the costume, to set, to new writing, to every, it was incredible. And, simultaneously everyone would be doing these mad degrees. And so you were juggling that. And then, yeah, in my final year, I think I did 20 plays in 3 years.
Wow.
Which is mad and not much of my degree, but I scraped through. And, right. But yeah, in my last year, I applied to this thing called the Marlowe Showcase and where you can audition in your final year to be part of a showcase where they bring in an external director. I think, I can't remember his name, it's terrible. I think his name was Nick. And I'm so sorry,
who's
Nick.
To say?
Who's to say? And he was amazing and he had done a lot of work and he had an incredible career and he brought us a lot of advice and wisdom as we chose our monologues. We chose a modern and a classic and I wasn't Judy Dench in that. And we did one show in Cambridge to our friends, which was amazing and fun, and one terrifying show in London to a room full of agents who were silent the entire time. And also the worst part of this was they made us do, as well as monologues, they were like, we think it'd be a really nice little icebreaker for you guys if you do a little sort of welcome dance.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So actually it was kind of great. My friends Toby and Lucy, who went on to write the musical Six, wrote our I was at Cambridge with them and they wrote our welcome dance. And I'm sure there is actually probably a record. Someone probably has a video of it, but it was terrible.
Now that you mention it, actually.
Oh, God, down. Can you imagine?
Well.
It was awful. It was like, da, 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 and I'll be Juliet, da, da. It was horrible. But somehow I got approached from that by an agent called Maya, who at the time was actually an associate agent. She was just a few years older than me. And I don't know, there was something about her. I guess she still has it. She's like a bloodhound. She just doesn't stop. She's incredible. She's so savvy and so smart and knows exactly what she wants. And I don't know, it was, she was so inspiring to me. And also we just really connected, and she just had a lot of hope and really believed in me. And also I felt very seen by her.
Yeah.
And in safe hands. And I was her first ever client.
Wow.
So she's now started her own agency, and she's amazing, and I'm so proud of her. And it's incredible to grow with someone.
Totally.
It's like, it's an amazing thing. So
now, I don't know if this is the same agent who I've heard about, where, let me figure out how to set this up. So your first association with the Crown had nothing to do with you being even potentially up for a job on the Crown, right? So you were still at Cambridge, and they're casting season 3.
Yeah.
And just for the record, your Princess Diana doesn't show up till season 4. So can you just explain how you wind up even in the room with the people from the Crown for the first time?
Yeah. It was so weird. Also, to finish answer your last question, which I didn't answer at all, actually, I realized. I signed with Maya like in my last few months of uni, and she was very quickly like, I'm gonna start making you do tapes, self tapes. I was like, yeah, sure, great, fine, I can handle this. Like, terrible. I was terrible at them, because obviously, like, theatre is so larger than life most of the time, and screen requires like nothing, and which is like minimal expression, and that took a long time to get used to. And Maya was brutal with me, which was great because I really needed it. You know, I'd do a tape or something and she'd say, no, again, no, again. And I was also really bad at like dressing for the role. I remember I did a tape for her for, I think, something like the new series of Dynasty or something, which was like shiny heels and like tight dresses. And I came in a pair of like white Levi's cutoffs and a like a checkered oversized blazer. And she was like, Emma, it looks like you're about to sell used cars. She was like, go home and change. But it was great. So we muddled through, but she basically just went and sent me to as many auditions as I could. And one of those happened to be the role of like a chambermaid or the queen's maid or something in The Crown, which I didn't get. And that was the first time I was in the room with them. And I think that was Nina Gold or Rob Stern who would have I would have seen for that. And that was end of summer of 2018, and then cut to sort of end of 2018. I was asked to, and it was also summer of 18, sorry, summer of 18, later on in the summer, I've said summer so many times. I was called back because they said we're auditioning the people up for Camilla for season 3, and we need a reader, and would you come and read some of the scenes as Diana? So
quick note, that was one of the people you read, because opposite, because she got the part, was
Emerald,
who was here a few months ago. She was great.
And she's amazing.
So you read opposite her, having been told by your representation, don't misconstrue this as an audition or something, right?
No. Yeah. Maya was very, very clear about that. She was like, this is not an audition. But then she was also like, it's not an audition. She said, look, it's kind of the perfect situation because you're not being watched. You're not being watched, but you also are being watched. Right. And so she said, it's, you can prepare, but it's sort of, you're off the hook.
And so, you were who reading opposite Camilla?
Diana.
You were Diana. Okay. And that was just, you think, purely coincidental, or do you think they in the back of their heads even were thinking in that at that time that you could be?
You know, I've genuinely never thought that. I actually don't know. I've known because they've told me. Suzanne Mackie, who's so wonderful and a dear friend now, and really I have to thank her and Peter for believing me from that day in that room, because I think we had a break for lunch and they sort of came out and were like, hi, who's this? And they seemed really interested in me, and that was surprising because I'd been told that like I was just going to be like nothing and on a wall, and I was to sort of, you know, meld into the background. So I don't know, maybe. But
that day they sort of started to plant the seed that it might be more than that?
Yeah. Well, they did. I swear they did. And I got a vibe. It was like meeting someone and being like, oh my God, I think there was something there. And then I remember going outside and calling Mara and being like, oh my God, I think they liked me. And she was like, they didn't. She's like, don't you dare. You can't think like that. It's like, have I taught you nothing? You can't get your hopes up in this industry. They will be crushed. So I didn't think anything of it. And then it was a very weird, long, like almost literal courtship of sort of like 8 or 9 months of like them checking my availability and for like, we can't say, but maybe this part. And yeah, it was very odd, like hearing bits and bobs from other directors that I'd start working with saying like, oh, you're the person who they're thinking of. And I'd be like, what? How do you know this? Someone once said it to me in the middle of a dinner. I did a few episodes of Pennyworth, and at the welcome dinner, the cast dinner, they were like, well, yeah, because, you know, they needed you to get some experience before you were Diana. And I was like, sorry, what?
I didn't get the memo. Yeah.
Yeah. And I went into the bathroom and I called Maya and she was like, no, you ignore it. And I was like, I promise they said this. And it was a few months of weird stuff happening. And then I got a formal sort of invite to audition.
And this time it's opposite Josh O'Connor, who played Prince Charles?
No, it was in a room with Peter Morgan and Ben Caron and Rob Stern. And we just talked about Diana. And we also then did a duet of Phantom of the Opera, which is bizarre. Like, the experience couldn't have been weirder.
Right.
And then I got invited to set where Josh was filming some stuff and for season 3. And yeah. And they got down, Ben Caron got down on one knee and offered me the role. And it was amazing. It's the best appraisal I'll ever get.
Suzanne Mackey, who I guess ultimately signs off on casting decisions there, she said, this was at the time, quote, it felt like one of the most special intuitive decisions I've made in my career. Emma froze. She started to cry. Ben started to cry. And Josh gave her a big hug. It was really emotional. There was such a purity in it, close quote. But I understand that pretty quickly after, and in this case, I think it's Ben Caron, who's one of the directors, says to you, things are about to get weird, right?
Yeah, if they hadn't been weird already. Right. Yeah, he came into this trailer that I'd be given for the day and sort of like grabbed me in a frenzy and was like, okay, listen. He's like, everything that happens to you from this moment on, use it, because you'll be going through exactly, like, your life's going to change. Like, people are going to be following you around, be taking pictures of you, and everything that happens to you from this moment will be exactly what happened to her. So, like, use it. And he wasn't wrong. It was very strange, sort of weird parallel.
Now, the chronology, we should note, you were born, I think, only like 2 years before Diana passed away. So it's not like you would have a living memory of her. So what did you kind of, what was your, I don't know if it was taught in schools or whatever, what did you know about Diana going into this? And then what did you have to quickly learn to go to work on this?
I'm kind of glad, I think, that I didn't have a living memory of her. I think it was kind of useful because, yeah, I could start from scratch. And, but obviously I knew what everyone know, like, just that even if I didn't have a living memory of her, I just had this huge impression of her. Like, it was, she left an impression on everyone, and she really like still had a presence, certainly in the UK. And I think the whole world, in that way that she made everyone feel like they knew her and she connected with them, and it's remarkable. So yeah, I felt that, and I had engaged with that, I suppose, as everyone has. And but no, I didn't really know much beyond that.
This could be BS that's out there, I don't know, but does someone in your family?
Yeah. I wasn't gonna do the whole thing, but yeah, so the other connection I have to Diana is that my mum resembles her. She doesn't not resemble her. And it was a sort of running joke throughout my childhood, especially at school, that my mum was sort of, yeah, her likeness. And that sort of followed me around a lot. And then, yeah, my mum has this story that she once told me that the day that Diana passed away, my mom was in a train station in London. I think it was Euston Station. She went to use the restroom in a restaurant in the station, and someone fainted because they thought that it was Diana.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. So you go to work on what was, I mean, you, like you said, you'd done Pennyworth, you'd done a few smaller parts, but this is a major part in a major series that everyone's going to check out. And you report to work on a set that also includes Olivia Colman, Gillian Anderson, Helena Bonham Carter, and I could go on for the rest of the time we have together. So were you intimidated? If you were not, how not? Just what, your first time in the deep end, what was that like?
Yeah, it was the most overwhelming thing ever. It was really like deep end, no armband sort of, yeah. But I owe a lot of it, I think, actually to the team, like Ben Karen and Suzanne Mackey, for sure, who really made me immediately feel as comfortable as I could be in that situation. And also Helena, who I was invited to a season 3 screening, and I met them all there, or most of them. And Helena was just incredible. She was like, come on you, come for a cup of tea. And we actually at the time lived quite close to each other. So I then spent quite a lot of that time with her, and it was amazing. And I think getting to know her and her immediately taking me under her wing in such a generous, gorgeous way meant that when I got to set, I didn't feel like I was being sort of drowning in imposter syndrome as much as I could have done. Mm. Yeah.
So you shoot this season. As we all know, The Crown periodically alternates actors within the same, playing the same parts. So this was going to be a one season assignment, then you're handing it off to Elizabeth Debicki. Is there any coordination? Like, do you guys compare notes and, hey, you know, make sure you're doing this or not doing this or whatever? Or are you just like, good luck?
No, I think it's really left up to the actor who's taking it on. And I think that, yeah, she didn't reach out. And I don't think that, I think that's totally great. I think that everyone has their own process. And I understand that actually, like, I don't know what we would have talked about, because I think that the beauty of The Crown is that everyone gets to bring to life a different, like, you know, version of this person. It's why The Crown is so great. It's why ultimately The Crown is, you know, you could argue mostly fictional. Like, it's these, you know, portrayals of by these incredible people. And yeah, Elizabeth.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
That did an amazing job.
Last Crown question. Your season dropped on November 15th, 2020, right in the thick of the global pandemic. On the one hand, I guess people had nothing to do but sit at home and watch television. On the other hand, there were not things that there usually would be, like in-person premieres and promotion and things like that. So what was that period like for you, where everybody suddenly aware of you, but you're not necessarily getting that feedback in the real world like any other time in history would have been the case for somebody in your position?
It was weird. It was sort of a blessing and a curse, in the sense that I was so protected from the circus that I would have experienced otherwise. Like, I was just in my flat that I still live in now with my three mates who I still live with now and have lived with for a long time. So they really know me and like nothing changed. Like literally nothing really changed. I was like followed around a bit if I went out to do stuff and that got weird. But apart from that, I really wasn't exposed to much of the sort of, yeah, the circus that there normally is. And, you know, I've been exposed to it now and it's horrible. So, and overwhelming, but.
Also, you pretty quickly went back to work, right? I mean,
yeah.
You produced a lot of material. I don't even want to say films because it wasn't limited to films, but in the years of and since the worst of the pandemic, I mean, two films that came out in 2022 must have been in the works at the time or shortly thereafter when we were consuming The Crown. Mm-hmm. If I can just tee those up for you, just yeah. First one, which was the one that I think was shot first, but came out second, maybe, was My Policeman.
Yeah.
This is you playing Marion Taylor, the wife of Tom, who was played by Harry Styles, a man who embarks on an affair with their mutual friend, David Dawson's character, Patrick, in Michael Grandage's film, which you mentioned. I'm trying to remember. I think this was premiered at Toronto.
Yeah.
And you guys were honored as a cast there. Mm. But I guess the kind of, we should talk about Michael because he was such a big influence for you. And also as a person who also comes from the theater, fights for rehearsal to an extent that you're not usually going to get on a screen project, no. Right?
Yeah.
So how in that case, I think it was like 3 weeks. How important is that for you?
It is important. I think you very quickly get used to the fact that you don't really get it with film and TV. And you sort of pivot and you adapt to that. But it was amazing what Michael fought for and so unprecedented. Yeah, we had about, I think David and Harry had 3 weeks. I was with them for 2 weeks. But it was really amazing. Like we could, because that, the bond between those three people in that film is what the film hinges on
right.
completely. And so to like really get to know each other and to be in a room together and with Michael, who's just like, he comes alive in a rehearsal room. He's fantastic. And I found it so inspiring to work with him. Yeah, it was brilliant. I'm so glad he fought for that. I think more people should.
So then pretty immediately after, I think, is Lady Chatterley's Lover, which was on Netflix. And here you're playing Constance, Lady Chatterley, who, for anyone who needs a reminder, this upper-class woman whose husband gets paralyzed and then has an affair with, I believe, her gardener. In this case, Jake O'Connell. I don't want to... The Josh and Jake O'Connell...
Jack O'Connell.
I keep confusing. So now there's something about this version. The story was scandalous when it was first mm-hmm. written, but now film has gotten to the point where you can do whatever you want, pretty much. And an aspect of this one that I think might have deterred a lot of people from doing it is something that you have said was actually the reason to do it. Can mm-hmm. you expand upon that?
The nudity?
There's quite a bit, and there's dancing in the... I mean, this is not just like kind of a snippet. I mean, it's integral to the
yeah,
film.
There's a lot of it.
And you seem to have not been bothered by that.
It was something about the way that it was written in the scripts. I mean, the book was sort of banned, I think. It was made illegal when it was published. And I think even now it's an extraordinary book to read. It's still somehow ahead of its time. And even being written by a man is bonkers. But he does a good job. And the adaptation of the script I thought was really sensitive and also bold. And when I found out that it was Laure de Clermont-Tonnerre who was going to direct it, and I'd loved her film Mustang. Mm-hmm. And I really, once I knew it was her, I could totally see her vision immediately come off the page. And that made me want to do or really dig into those aspects of the film, like the nudity, and because I just knew that she'd do it well. Mm-hmm. In like a French way, French cinema, which has been right. breaking boundaries with that kind of, with those kind of themes for ages.
Right.
And there was an, we worked with Benoit Delhomme, who's an incredible cinematographer. Mm-hmm. And those two as a duo worked so well together and made scenes like dancing, running around under rain machines in autumn in Wales, completely naked, like bearable, which was... But yeah, I mean, look, it's an experience I'll never, ever forget. And I don't know if I'll ever do anything like that again. And I'm really glad I did. It was also a really incredible experience in sort of building trust with another actor, mm-hmm. because you really have to be there for each other and support each other. And that was another film actually that we did have rehearsal time, which I think was really needed, because there's no way you could go into dealing with that subject matter, like being like, oh, hi, nice to meet you. Like, you just can't. Yeah, and we did a lot of sort of, moving around the space together and working. We did about 1 or 2 weeks with an intimacy coordinator, figuring out all our boundaries and, you know, safe words and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, just as a quick funny aside, so on the heels of The Crown, My Policeman and Lady Chatterley's Lover, a person, I think, profiling you wrote, mm-hmm. quote, Emma Corrin certainly has a thing for characters who marry unwisely. Now, that was just the first few roles. It gets, that's a little reductive, but it was kind of funny. So, now the theater was never, it's not like, oh, I'm getting screen roles, I'm done with the theater. You continued to, it seems like, go back and forth during those last few years. 2021, your debut on the West End in Anna X, which I think was... only called that because they would have been sued if they called it Anna Delvey,
yeah,
right?
I think probably, yeah.
Which was basically about this. So that one. Now then in July 2022, it's announced in Playbill and everywhere that you were going to be starring in a production of Orlando. And I wonder, just before we go any further with that, can you share, you know, your synopsis of what Orlando is about if anyone hasn't seen it?
Wow, yeah.
Would you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's based on a book by, Orlando is a book, by Virginia Woolf. And it follows a young man and throughout the story and his sort of journey with sort of basically finding himself. And through this journey, it's weirdly hard to explain. It's so fantastical. It traces his life over a period of time and in many different like cities and countries and places, and halfway through the story, without much explanation at all, he becomes a woman. And it's so beautifully done because it's never explained nor seemed to need any justification, as it shouldn't. And it's about, finding love and finding yourself and finding peace with your identity and celebrating that. And it's really hard to put it into words because it travels through time and it travels through gender and it travels through relationships and place. So it's hard to pinpoint
but
you should read it. It's really beautiful. And it's a book that you can always come back to. And it's one of those ones that no matter at whichever point you pick it up in your life, it will teach you something new.
And you've said that long before you played Orlando in Orlando, you were familiar with the text.
Yeah. And actually another weird sort of life thing is that Virginia Woolf wrote it about Vita Sackville West, who she was in love with for a very long time. And Vita Sackville West grew up in a house called Knoll House, which I grew up next to.
Wow.
Yeah, so my sort of street was next to Knoll House, and they have this crazy park, and the house is a calendar house. So it has 365 rooms and like 52 staircases, and it's like built like a calendar.
Wow.
And they reference it in Orlando. And so it was kind of a nice, it was always a nice, I don't know, felt like I was connected to it in a way.
Now, to whatever extent if you'd like to engage with this, I'm curious, art can fuel real life, like real life can fuel art. In the same month that you were announced that you were going to be doing Orlando, that was when you sort of were a trailblazer in your own way by putting your pronouns on Instagram as they, them. Mm-hmm. Is that coincidental, or is that just like, did you think that the being in the orbit of the art made you more, or being familiar with that particular piece of art may have made you more open to that?
That's so funny. Again, I didn't know that that was around the same time. I remember being in New York and shooting A Murder at the End of the World when that was happening, because I remember I did the cover of Vogue US and I had an interview, and I remember someone saying, you know, this is the first time a non-binary person would have been on the cover of US Vogue, and because of that, the interview will be sort of about gender, if that's all right. And that was sort of terrifying, in as much as it was an honor. So I think I very much, feel like that was the point. And I guess, Orlando had been announced by then. But I think you can't separate those things. I think that undoubtedly, as my identity journey was progressing, the art I was doing was providing a lot of questions that I wanted answers for in terms of how I saw myself, and also providing a lot of those answers. And I think when Michael brought Orlando to me when we were doing My Policeman, and at that point I hadn't explicitly come out at all. So, but I think Michael and I were very close, and I think that he probably got a sense of it, even if I hadn't totally myself, which is kind of beautiful. And I remember he bought me the script and said, I would never do this with anyone else but you. So if you don't do it, I won't do it. Which is crazy. And but to be honest, the main thing I feel like will really answer your question is that during Orlando, it was it was a gift. I mean, for someone who was in the midst of, I don't think one ever finishes one's journey figuring out one's identity, really, but certainly in the midst of the beginning of that, I suppose, to do that play and to be on stage every night and say these celebratory lines, these amazing glorifying lines about how you can be anyone you want to be and you don't need to explain it and it doesn't need to be fixed. And it was incredible. It's almost like an exercise that a therapist would give you, say these things every day until you ingest them and until it feels real to you. And it was amazing. It was so, I couldn't have wished for something more affirming. And I think it was, an incredible experience.
Just a quick follow-up. Do you think that that journey and coming out, has it influenced the parts that you pursue, that you've pursued since then? Because, I mean, I'll just read again another quote, which I don't know if this is correct, but it's interesting. New York Times wrote when they were writing about Murder at the End of the World, quote, Darby is the least femme screen role Corin has played, close quote, which I guess, again, I think I've seen most of your work, but I can't confirm that. Is that, again?
Yeah, definitely. I think apart from Orlando,
right.
I think, Darby is definitely the most androgynous, and that was great.
Yeah.
It felt really wonderful to be able to knock about in basketball shorts and feel a bit like,
get
I can really identify
pieces,
this. Right. Yeah. But, identity, fluidity is not about shutting off the female parts of myself. I love those parts of myself. It's about embracing others as well. And so, I love playing female roles. I'll never stop doing that. And and so, Darby is... she's amazing, and I love bringing her to life.
So Darby, we've in this room just watched the trailer at the least, and many people have seen all of the great program, but for anyone listening who needs a brief, a amateur detective, I guess would be the way to put it, maybe, who is very effective at solving some disappearances or murders and throughout middle America, in tandem with her boyfriend, Bill, who later she reconnects with when he is now a kind of an activist artist.
Yeah, like a guerrilla artist.
Yeah, yeah. Like yeah. a, Yeah.
He's got a cool job.
She's now higher profile, having written about their adventures together, but it's been 6 years since they were together. And now they're both invited to this retreat at a billionaire's property. And he turns up dead. And now it's a matter of what happened.
Yeah.
This is from Britt Marling and Zal Bettmanglage, they who previously teamed on the OA. And actually, Britt was here, I think, 2 or 3 weeks ago. Otherwise, we would have screened A Murder, except we'd already just screened it. So a lot of people are familiar with it. But just were you familiar with their work before? And how was this pitched to you?
I was familiar with their work. I hadn't actually seen the OA at that time, but I'd heard so much about it. I mean, it was such a cult thing. And one of those things that you know is brilliant because, you know, people either love it or haven't heard of it, or, you know, it's one of these things that people are so passionate about. I mean, when series two was canceled, people camped outside Netflix. Right. I mean, it was incredible.
Right.
And Brit and Zal have this way of creating worlds that are like, they really suck you in. They flesh out characters in the most dynamic and complex ways. And as people, they have an incredible magnetism. You said Britt was here.
Yeah.
I want to write down everything she says.
Yeah.
She's incredible. It's amazing. It's like they are both channeling something from another world. I genuinely believe that. They're incredible minds, and it's reflected in their work.
Now, so the idea, I mean, obviously you've done long form in the sense of a series with The Crown, but the idea of doing, it's 7 episodes of about an hour or so, but I think it's a different kind of schedule than when you're doing The Crown. Can you explain how long, how widespread this whole production was, and how you responded to that way of working?
Yeah, it was a lot. It was, it was a real lesson in hubris, I think, because I read the script and I was like, this is amazing. She's in every single scene. This is going to be great. And then, like, you know, 8 months later and I can't walk and I'm like, I've never been so exhausted in my life, but it was incredible. It was an amazing team to work with. And we went to some extraordinary places. Like, we started in Iceland, and then we shot in these stages in New Jersey. And then we, an amazing place, another incredible place. And and then went to Utah. So three amazing places. Yeah, got it all. Yeah.
and this may, it may be an idiotic question, but I think it's slightly less idiotic if it's dealing with a limited series, but do you shoot in sequence, in blocks? How do you do it with that long of a and plus the show itself is jumping all over in time.
Yeah. No, we didn't shoot in order. We shot all the exteriors first in Iceland, which was very cold. And then they built the hotel in the stages in New Jersey. And which was mad because it was literally, they built a physical functioning hotel. And that we lived in for about 5 months.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, it was wild. As in, we didn't stay there. Sorry.
FX has a...
Yeah, functioning was probably the wrong word to use. It was... But in that, like, normally... I mean, you have incredible stages here. I took a peek around and that's wild. I can't imagine what it's like to have that. It's amazing. Previously on stages, I'd been... They have, like, you know... Stage A will have like the living room and the stage will have this room. And, you know, if it's a house, they'll all be broken up. But they built like a two-story hotel with that crazy staircase that you see. And all the rooms down the corridor were like in order, and the living room, the dining room. It was absolutely mad. Yeah. But an amazing world. It really felt like you could be immersed in it. And the same with being in Iceland. Like, we shot under the northern lights, like in a canyon and glaciers and on a frozen lake. We got to set on snowmobiles. It was wild. But no, not in order.
How do you, as a performer, deal with that? Especially because you started in the theater where you're doing it in order and repeatedly. Do you like, basically, is it a matter of mapping it out, charting it somehow yourself?
Yeah, it is. It's just sort of, you just have to be on it and sort of, you kind of get used to it, I suppose. Like, it's just something you accept ultimately, but it is just having a map of what, like, what comes before a scene and what comes after to remember those beats. And also, you just have to have a really good sense of the through line of the script. So I guess it ultimately comes down to knowing how well you know the work. Mm-hmm. And, but it kind of worked quite beautifully. I was speaking to Britt about an interview about it this morning, and it was kind of lovely because in retrospect, we realized that the last part of the series that we shot was in Utah. And that was almost, it wasn't chronological, but we went to Utah and we did most of the Darby and Bill flashback scenes where they fall in love. And the interviewer this morning said, well, wouldn't it have made more sense to do that? Don't you wish you'd done that at the beginning so that you could know what it was like to fall in love with this person and then to do the scenes where you've lost him? And I thought, yeah, like that would make a lot of sense. But but then it was kind of beautiful in the way it ended up working, because there was this, and then what made me think of it was there was a scene in we shot in Utah where Darby and Bill first meet and Frank Ocean's Moon River is playing. And they actually played that in the scene, which was so moving. And we did a few takes of it. And Zal came up to me and said, just a quick note, but at this moment, could you try and communicate when Darby sees Bill that in that instant she falls in love with him and simultaneously knows that she's going to lose him? And I was like, wow.
Small,
tiny note, yeah. No problem. But it was a beautiful note. And it is so true, I think, also of young love or first love, or I guess any love, really, if you think about it, because you always know that you're going to lose the person. And that's what makes love so beautiful, because it has that fragility. It's why you invest so much. It's why you care so much. It's why you want to hold on to that person. And it makes it really precious. And I think that because we'd played out the end, I knew how it was going to end. And so it made these 2 weeks in Utah really beautiful and really precious and imbued with this sense of like this snapshot, this really, yeah, precious moment in time that they wouldn't get back, even if they didn't know it then. That's so funny. Yeah, it was that.
To think about it. Yeah. So you for The Crown were nominated and or won a zillion awards in the category of best actress in a drama series. You are now being promoted for best actress in a limited series. Mm-hmm. How does that sit with you, given, you know, you, being non-binary, do you feel that the industry has work to do in terms of how they classify these things? Or I've heard the counter argument that it can actually be, it can have unintended consequences. If, I mean, there are some places like the Spirit Awards, others who have tried different things. So anyway, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on that. Yeah. And it's a difficult question. I always get quite scared of answering it, but I'm, because it is such a huge question and it sort of requires multiple answers. And I think it's undoubtable that there is more work to do. It was incredible and it felt really affirming to be at the Independent Spirit Award and to be nominated in a performer category. It was amazing. You know, you feel seen, you feel like someone's creating space for you to be recognized for your work, which, say what you will about the award system and the meritocracy of it, but it's a really lovely thing to be recognized, undoubtedly. So to be able to do that in a space that doesn't compromise you in any way in your identity is a really great thing. And I know the BIFFers, I think, in the UK are doing it, and that's wonderful. And I hope that, as you said, if, you know, there are kinks to be worked out in these things, and I think that that can only be done by including those. I just hope that these the decision makers in the awards bodies are including those voices in the rooms where they are making these changes, because I think that if, as long as those conversations are being had, there's a way of working these things out. But, you know, at the same time, I think in the framework as it stands with the awards bodies, where the categories are still actor and actress, I think for me, and I think also it's really important to say that for every single performer, it will be a different case because no person's identity journey is the same. And I think for me, operating in the framework as it stands, I think that if I'm nominated as in the best actress category, the visibility of that, I think, is the most important thing. I think in almost the worst case scenario would be that no non-binary people were being nominated in categories, albeit in gendered categories, because then it removes them completely.
Right.
And I would rather be visible and be honored for work. And I guess, like, finally, to say that, you know, as long as I'm playing female characters, I think that that's also, you know, Darby's a female character. So there is also the argument that it also makes sense to be nominated in an actress category for that part. Yeah. I hope that is...
Oh, it's great. It's thought-provoking. Yeah. It really is. Thank you. You have two very highly anticipated films that I believe are in the can and coming out before the end of this year. We have Deadpool and Wolverine. You are, I believe, the villain. And we have, from Robert Eggers of The Lighthouse and many other things, Nosferatu. I do know how it works. You can't say probably too much, but anything you could tease about these for us?
I get so scared about talking about
The young people
Deadpool.
Here, don't you want to?
I'm not going to say anything about Deadpool because I'm worried that they're, like, listening. I don't know where they are, but they're listening.
Right.
But it was one of the best experiences of my life. It was wild. Wow. It was like being a kid in a candy factory, candy shop. Yeah, it was amazing. Ryan Hugh and Sean Levy, who directed it, they're just incredible. And there's so much fun on that set. It was an amazing experience. Sean is an amazing director because he has such vision and he knows exactly what he wants, which I guess you have to when you're dealing with that, like, big scope of production. He knows exactly what he wants from his shots. And from the day, and then because he's that prepared, he can have so much fun with it. And him and Ryan do have so much fun. And obviously, I think it's no secret that they, you know, improv and they change stuff. And it was a real masterclass in that, and also comedy, which I'm, yeah, learning. Yeah, it was great. And I'm excited for people to see it. It's a fun one.
Awesome. Last one for me. Is there anything that is on your bucket list that maybe has not come up yet, or maybe you have a secret yearning to do a musical or something? Like, what might people not know that if the right person's listening to this when it posts as a podcast, it might be good to put it out there in the universe, something that you'd love to do that you haven't yet gotten to do?
I always have answers to these questions, and then when they're asked, I always forget. I watched a film recently called Perfect Days.
Mm-hmm.
The Wim Wenders film.
Japanese.
Yeah. And it was beautiful in the way that it, like, drifted, and in the way that it was almost a silent film. And I remember working with Benoit and Chatterley, and he said, I think you should do a silent film one day. And I thought that would be quite an interesting thing. There's just something really meditative, and especially in the pace of how we live our lives these days, really unusual and interesting about watching someone do a repeated routine. I just felt so inspired. It's like, it was really a film about paying attention, and it made me pay attention. And yeah, doing something with that quality, I think, would be really fun.
Awesome. All right, we are going to take three smart questions.
Hi, Emma. My name is Sarah Jane. I'm a junior screenwriter here. I actually grew up in Surrey since I was 13, so
no
I
way.
Totally get the A-level drama, GCSE, and being overdramatic and silly. But I wanted to ask you, acting is really, I think, brave and very bold. And I wanted to ask you, what makes you brave?
What makes me brave? The first thing that springs to mind is my friends. I think having people who believe in you and who provide a sort of pillow for you to fall on if you've been brave and it's scary, I think that helps. I don't know, is there something that, like, in the fact that fear can kind of help you be brave? I don't know. There's something I've kind of found with Darby, maybe, that I enjoyed playing her fear because I thought it was unusual that you'd never really see detectives be scared. And I think through being scared and making visible your fear, there is a bravery in that. So, yeah.
Thank you. I think we have a mic on this side, which I will defer to the... Okay.
Hi. Hi, Emma. Thank you so much for coming. Before I ask my question, it's such a small world because I also went to the same secondary school as you did.
You went to Woldingham?
Yes, I did.
Shut up. That's
really
so cool.
Crazy.
What a small world.
Yeah.
Great theatre, right? With the orchestra thing that goes
You were also very much a big... Your poster was all over the school.
Well, I want to know because when I was there, it was all Carey Mulligan. It was just all... Oh, no. It was like a wall. It was like a shrine.
You're amazing. There too. You're definitely there too.
Honestly, all I wanted. That's all I wanted. I can go home now.
And yeah, your name is on the ribbons board as well. And everyone... Yeah.
God, the ribbons. That's wild.
But yeah, I just wanted to say I also loved you on The Crown. And obviously with talking about the royal family and stuff, I know the show says that like, oh, it's... Not everything is based in obviously reality, but... Were you ever worried that like maybe the royal family would kind of be like, stop, this is not true. Did anyone ever warn you in your life where they're kind of like nervous for you? Because obviously it's a show about the royal family.
I mean, obviously you think about it, but no, I think that The Crown is really good in ultimately, you know, it's scripted and they very much make you feel that, you know, you're going to set, you're saying words that Peter's written and... you're with a bunch of actors. And so it feels very far away from the real thing, which I think is good probably for both parties in that situation. Yeah.
Thanks for coming. You're such an inspiration. To finish off this interesting connection thread, I actually applied to RADA and didn't get in either. But I can blame them. I'm not a good actress. But well, do you... draw inspiration from kids as an actor, and also on Murder at the End of the World, you worked with a younger actor. How differently was it?
That's such a great question. I think kids are constant inspiration. I think their ability to play, I mean, there's an argument that actors are just like kid, you know, people who've never really grown up. I think, yeah, they have kids have an abandon and an immediacy and a curiosity. And an unfiltered way of seeing the world and also responding to the world that we lose. And I think working with children is, you know, it reminds you of that. I think it's a really, it's a great thing to work with young actors and with kids. I think it's, yeah, it's really inspiring. It kind of makes you loosen up a bit and not take yourself so seriously. I think there's a lot to learn from them. Mm. Yeah.
I will just close by saying thank you so much for coming up here. We really appreciate it. It's very special to
thanks for having
you.
Me. Thank you. Thanks. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate it and would really appreciate you taking just a minute more to subscribe to the podcast and to leave us a rating and review on your podcast app. And to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where our handle is @AwardsChatter. On those platforms, we announce upcoming guests and provide details about special live recordings of the podcast that you can attend. Until next time, thanks again for tuning in.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino. With cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.